I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Just one day after insisting that Iranian operatives are bringing powerful explosives into Iraq to use against U.S. troops, President Bush focused on another part of the war on terror, Afghanistan. In a speech this morning, the president urged NATO nations to join the U.S. in sending more troops to Afghanistan ahead of a spring offensive against the Taliban.
Snow is going to melt in the Hindu Kush Mountains, and when it does, we can expect fierce fighting to continue. Taliban and Al-Qaeda are preparing to launch new attacks. Our strategy is not to be on the defense, but to go on the offense.
In a news conference yesterday, the president identified a branch of Iran's Revolutionary Guard known as the Quds Force, and he said this force is bringing into Iraq what are called explosively formed projectiles, and those are new weapons which the military says are killing greater numbers of U.S. soldiers. But President Bush stopped short of saying that top Iranian government leaders are the ones ordering the Quds Force. The issue is dominating the headlines because of concerns that faulty intelligence may again lead the U.S. into military action, this time against Iran. Well, joining me on the line is Dmitry Sevastopulo, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dmitry, is the Bush administration more on one page today about this Iranian evidence? Because obviously earlier this week there were a lot of reports about contradictory comments from General Peter Pace.
Deborah, I don't think that they're on the same page. I mean, they're trying to make it look like they're on the same page. But what's clear is that there's not conclusive evidence that the top leadership of the Iranian government, which would be Ayatollah al-Khamenei, has been ordering attacks inside Iraq. Mm. President Bush tried to get himself out of that yesterday by suggesting that it was the al-Quds force, which is an elite paramilitary force, part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which reports to the Ayatollah. But a lot of skepticism, I think, from other people saying that, well, the case has not been made very clearly, and is this another case of the administration ramping up criticism or intelligence for a pretext to go to war?
Hmm. So just explain this Quds force, if you would. This is a force under the Revolutionary Guard, as you said. Who do these soldiers report to? Who are they?
They're basically an elite branch or kind of subsection of the Revolutionary Guard. They report directly to the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. They don't report to President Ahmadinejad. And one of the interesting things yesterday was when President Bush was saying that the U.S. didn't know whether Ahmadinejad had ordered attacks by the Quds inside Iran. Ahmadinejad has no power over the Quds. He never has, and he has actually very little power over foreign policy at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where is this intelligence on Iran coming from? Can you explain that?
There are several things. The U.S. has recovered, you mentioned the explosively formed projectiles a little earlier. They've recovered some of the fragments on these. There are serial numbers which suggest that they come from Iran. The fragments themselves, the types of technology which they say link them back to Iran. And then in the last few weeks, the Americans have swept up what they call parts of networks who are supplying these weapons inside Iraq. And they say they've captured Iranians who have linked them back to the al-Quds or the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. But they haven't provided, well, they've shown fragments of the weapons. They haven't provided any conclusive evidence that it is actually the Revolutionary Guard who are supplying these.
Okay. And what about Iranian dissidents? How much are they involved in providing intelligence, would you say?
We don't know. There's a group inside Iraq called the MEK, and actually a splinter group of the MEK was the one that came out a couple of years ago and revealed that the Iranians had a covert uranium enrichment program inside Iran. It's not clear to what extent they're working with the Americans to try and provide intelligence on Iranian operations inside Iraq, but there's some suggestions that they might be.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hearing inside the Pentagon? Do you think that the military does want to aggressively go after Iran?
My sense from talking to officials, including Secretary Gates, I traveled with him to Munich and to Europe last week, is that they do not. While you have a lot of strong rhetoric coming out of the State Department and the White House in recent weeks, interestingly, Secretary Gates on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago said that any kind of military action in Iran would be absolutely the last resort and would lead to very negative consequences for America around the world, including inside Iraq. I think what the Pentagon is saying, you've seen a kind of a coalescence of several issues. A battle group has been sent to the Gulf. You now have two battle groups that are going to be there. You've got these raids sweeping up Iranians inside Iraq, which has led people to believe that there's imminent military action. But I think the view inside the Pentagon is that any kind of military action on Iran would have very negative ramifications. I think one of the suggestions is that the Americans are trying to make it look like they're doing more to pressure the Iranians in an effort to ward off Israel from doing anything rash, like an airstrike on Iran that could then backfire and have huge implications for the U.S. in Iraq and elsewhere.
You know, there was a recent story in Newsweek, and we just have a few seconds here, Dimitri, that said that really what's happening here is there's a hidden war with Iran inside Iraq on the part of the U.S. What do you think of that?
There are people making that suggestion. I don't think there's any conclusive evidence that that's what's going on. But with many of these things, you never know until the proof is in the pudding, as my mother would say.
All right. Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Dimitri.
Thank you, Deborah.
The recent tragic death of a Massachusetts preschooler after a prescription drug overdose is drawing attention to the question, how young is too young to prescribe antipsychotic drugs? 4-year-old Rebecca Riley was taking a potent cocktail of psychiatric drugs for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and bipolar disorder. She was diagnosed with these disorders when she was 2.5 years old. Her parents are now charged with murder for allegedly giving Rebecca the overdose, and her doctor has stopped practicing medicine while the state investigates. Dr. Janet Wozniak of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston wrote the paper that changed the way psychiatrists view bipolar disorder in children. Her paper said the disorder is a lot more common than most doctors realize, and her research eventually led to a dramatic increase in the number of children diagnosed with and being treated for bipolar disorder. Dr. Wozniak, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for including me today.
Can we start off by saying first, what is bipolar disorder?
Bipolar disorder is one of the most serious and impairing diagnoses in psychiatry, both adult or child. It's characterized by dramatic mood swings and mood shifts between mania and depression, and in children in particular, is often characterized by extreme anger, irritability, and rage episodes.
Mm-hmm. So how does someone tell the difference between a child, say, who's very emotionally explosive and is a toddler, and a child who's bipolar?
Well, at any age, the distinguishing normal mood ups and downs from the mood ups and downs of bipolar disorder is the challenge of a trained clinician. So, for example, I think if you had a room full of toddlers, if you go to a preschool, you'll see some kids singing or laughing or climbing on furniture, jumping around or touching or rolling on the floor, and that would all seem particularly completely normal. If a group of adults was doing that, you'd say that seemed quite odd. On the other hand, if among that group of children, there was one child who was especially loud, pushy, bossy, demanding, destructive, aggressive, we might say that that child stood out from the rest of them as being more intense in their emotional reactivity than the rest.
So are there guidelines then for you to say when this is definitively bipolar? You mentioned intensity, frequency, and severity. Are there more specific guidelines than that when you're dealing with very young children? And then what are the guidelines for treatment?
In most areas of medicine, a doctor will confirm a diagnosis with a blood test or an X-ray. And in psychiatry, we still don't have those objective measures. The test is, I'm going to ask a bunch of questions and make direct observations, and then I'm going to put that together and tell you if there's a diagnosis present. What has become the challenge in child psychiatry is that the diagnosis of bipolar disorder was really created initially with adults in mind. And for many years, even when I was doing my training in the late 80s and early 90s, I was taught that bipolar disorder was an adult diagnosis. The work that I started to do in the pediatric psychopharmacology unit, however, and we found that of the under age 12 children coming to us for an evaluation, 16% met the diagnostic criteria for mania. So 16% of our clinic population would suggest that this was not such a rare condition. Mm-hmm. So we set out to look at the children more closely and understand how it could be that we would have missed calling them bipolar in the past. And we came up with a couple of ideas about that. One is that most of the children have ADHD as well. Children having ADHD may have caused us to misdiagnose them as having only ADHD and not the mood symptoms on top of it. What people used to say, wicked bad ADHD or moody ADHD, or I have a child who's got such bad ADHD, he's always irritable and frustrated. Well, what we started to realize is if you are that moody, that the likelihood that you only have ADHD is low, and that the likelihood that you have a coexisting mood disorder is quite high.
But I'm wondering, once you say, okay, we can all agree here that what we've got going on is a bipolar disorder,
yes,
then the treatment for these kids is,
right,
is these drugs that are also an adult treatment,
yes,
for what was believed to have been an adult disorder.
That's entirely so. So the medications that we have for bipolar disorder, I guess we're fortunate that we have some at all, but they were all designed with adult psychiatry in mind, and all have received their FDA approval for treatment of adults with the disorder. We, of course, would love to have a whole body of safety and effectiveness data on all of these medications in children, and most of us who work in this field are working feverishly to amass this type of information. However, until we have it, one level of evidence is the medicines we use in adults. Because the evidence is shakier, we have to weigh out the risks, the unknowns that may be associated with the use of these medicines in children versus the potential risks of not treating.
So it may not be thoroughly researched, and it's up to the clinician then to determine dosage and appropriateness of,
mm-hmm,
of treatment. And then you talk about this risk of not treating, and I think for many of us listening, you're talking about what's the risk if a three-year-old doesn't take these medications? I mean, how great of a risk is that?
This, I think, is really the heart of the matter, and I often find myself being the unhappy messenger, bringing this bad news that serious and highly disabling psychiatric conditions can start not only in children and adolescents, but from the very beginning of life. And about 25% of the parents said to us, I can't give you an age of onset. My child's been different and problemed from the get-go. As an infant, irritable, difficult to soothe, didn't establish regular sleeping patterns. By the time they could toddle and walk and talk, vicious, nasty comments, goofy, hyper statements came out of their mouth that was out of touch with reality. They would use their hands and feet not only to play, but to pick things up and break them and crash them and attack people. Depression and suicidality are part and parcel of bipolar disorder in adults, and unfortunately, I have to tell you that this afflicts children as well.
Even
preschool-age children often voice suicidal statements. Attempts at suicide is something that usually happens as children get older because they have more opportunity and more ability to formulate a plan. But I've had plenty of kids in my practice who talk about death or dying, think about using knives to hurt themselves or will pick them up, think open a window and think about or stand there to jump out. Usually the children at this age are supervised well enough that no harm befalls them in this regard, but parents are terrified of their children doing things to hurt themselves.
A sobering message, but the question remains, without scientific research to back up clinical observations, how young is too young to begin treatments for bipolar disorder? We're talking with Dr. Janet Wozniak. She's director of the Pediatric Bipolar Program at Massachusetts General Hospital. When we come back, we'll hear about the scant amount of research on the drugs used to treat children with bipolar disorder. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're looking at the issue of young children being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. 4-year-old Rebecca Riley of Massachusetts recently died after an overdose of psychiatric medicine. Her parents have been charged with murder. Dr. Janet Wozniak is director of the Pediatric Bipolar Clinic and Research Program at Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Wozniak, is it possible to diagnose bipolar disorder in a child as young as Rebecca Riley was when she was, 2.5 years old?
I think the younger the child is, the more complicated it is in terms of making a diagnosis and treatment plan, because even in child and adolescent psychiatry, we have emerging research. Our research in the toddler and preschool-age children is to call it emerging, I think, is an overstatement, because it's only something that we've started to work on. It's very hard to do research in preschoolers for a number of different reasons, but it's incumbent upon us as a field right now to work in this direction, because the disorder starts. The average age of referral to our clinic is 8, but that's not because that's when the symptoms start. It just takes that long to access care for most parents. Mm-hmm. They're put off. They try to consider that it might be normal development when they know that it isn't. They're dismissed by teachers and pediatricians and family members as not being powerful or competent enough parents. And parents are guilty creatures and will take it upon themselves to try to solve the problem. I'm not saying that this is clear and charted waters at this point, but clinicians are doing the best we can right now.
A clinical instructor at Harvard University, Dr. Jennifer Harris, she's quoted in the Boston Globe as saying that a lot of children are actually being misdiagnosed and that clinical practice here is getting way ahead of the science. I mean, is that in essence, would you acquiesce to that a little bit, or what would you say?
What the rate of misdiagnosis is, we don't know, and I'm sure that that's not only a problem in psychiatry, but in general. Because psychiatry doesn't have objective measures like blood tests and brain scans, it may make it more possible that clinicians could misstep. However, given what we think might be the prevalence of this disorder, and although we don't have an epidemiologic study, the number of maybe 1% of children and adolescents has been proposed based on indirect evidence, that means that there's nearly 1 million children and adolescents affected in the United States. And when I look at treatment patterns, even with the increase in diagnosis that you describe, an increase in prescription rates, that means that the vast majority of affected children are still unattended to and undiagnosed and untreated.
There's also the argument that diagnosing kids and possibly rushing to diagnose kids with bipolar disorder who could then get treatment. There are many who say, you know, this is parents who just want a quick fix. They want to control kids who may be a little wild, and we're really just over-medicating our children.
I think that that really is insulting to the clinicians who may be making these diagnoses, to suggest that a clinician would make a diagnosis like this and prescribe treatment for a child who's just a little wild is, I would say, a fairly serious misstatement. Children that are described in the psychiatric literature, and most of the cases that I see that come to me for referral, are children whose symptoms are clearly above and beyond what might be called a little wildness of childhood. To suggest that people are commonly turning to psychiatric medications because it's an easy solution doesn't seem to me to accurately reflect the state of affairs. Parents are miserable about doing this. They go to the pharmacy, and the pharmacist questions them and looks at them funny, and they don't want to tell their friends and relatives. In our society, the stigma associated with psychiatric diagnosis and treatment is enormous and blocks people from care. People aren't rushing to care to get these medicines. And the medicines are brutal in various ways. They all have miserable side effects. They have weight gain has been one of the most popularized one, with the risk for diabetes and elevated cholesterol and triglycerides. But the medicines can also be sedating, and it's annoying to take a medicine every day. Most of the parents are doing this because the symptoms are so severe, and they're terrified of the complications associated with long-term psychiatric illness.
And when we read about this case, a 4-year-old Rebecca Riley in Massachusetts, she was taking a variety of drugs, antipsychotic medication, mood medication, blood pressure medication, apparently. Mm-hmm. Is this sort of a normal routine for kids with these types of issues? And I know, you know, obviously you haven't seen her or anything like that, but when you read about it...
I can't comment on the case, but I can tell you in the treatment guidelines for pediatric bipolar disorder that was published about 2 years ago now, or a year and a half ago, in our Journal of Child Psychiatry, the first line of treatment is to try one medication. But if that doesn't work, it's clearly laid out that a second line of treatment is to combine two medications that may have mood-stabilizing properties. And increasingly, the literature suggests that using mood-stabilizing medicines in combination in children is more effective than using either one singly as a monotherapy agent.
And it seems like it would then be, again, equally or more complicated because, again, you don't have the research for children this young, and now you're talking about a mixture of drugs for a variety of issues.
That's entirely true. And in fact, what I often say is we work in uncharted waters, but that doesn't mean that we don't work. We still do our best as clinicians to offer what we can in terms of medicines for which we have a sense of their side effect profiles. At each step along the way, weighing the risks of leaving the child untreated versus the risks of using unknown combinations of medications. The fact that we use these unknown combinations of medications or unstudied is an indicator of how severe the symptoms are associated with the disorder.
What did you think when you first heard this story of Rebecca Riley and you were reading about it and hearing about the drug prescription and the bipolar disorder and then the overdose death?
Well, I'm very much hoping still that this case can help to highlight how much more research we need to understand these brain disorders that occur at the earliest stages of life. Just the opposite, though, I worry very much that such a case, in an opposite way, will only increase people's sense of fear and stigma and prevent families from bringing their children to appropriate consultation and diagnosis and treatment.
Dr. Janet Wozniak, Director of the Pediatric Bipolar Program at Massachusetts General Hospital, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new documentary takes a hard look at hip-hop and finds violence, misogyny, and homophobia. Also, the story of a man whose love for the lowly turtle gained him high praise and cold cash. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the Farm Belt of the United States, investors are increasingly fired up over ethanol, which is alcohol made from mashed grain. That's also a source of fuel. Although Henry Ford used ethanol to power his Model T back in 1908, it was more expensive than petroleum, so it was pretty much relegated to college fraternity parties. But after high energy prices, tax breaks, and government mandates for energy alternatives, ethanol is making a comeback, and not just as an American fuel, but as a way to revitalize some economically depressed areas of the country. Well, joining us is Tim Egan. He's reported on this resurgence in ethanol for the New York Times. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Deborah. It's great to be with you.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about places like Idaho and Missouri where, you know, they've had some hard times in the past few decades, but now they think ethanol is going to be their salvation? What's happening there?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, actually, there's this huge cross-section of the United States. About 40% of all counties in the country lost population in the last census and have pretty much been in a downward spiral for 30, 40 years. And there are places everywhere from upstate New York to a huge swath of the Midwest to the interior parts of the West, interior parts of the far West. And they all face the same problem. You know, it's the collapse of little agriculture towns because of big agriculture and consolidation in all these fields. So their hope now is they visualize getting sort of an ethanol plant in every town, and in fact, there's this huge ethanol boom going on that seems to indicate that the trend is not only a hope, but it's actually happening. But they see this as something that'll bring jobs back to small-town America, that'll give, you know, an extra source for how to sell their crops, that will bring new money in, that will give them energy independence, and will transform this huge section of the United States that's now in trouble into, you know, this vision of a sustainable economy.
So this ethanol boom and these communities wanting this, explain what exactly is the reality happening here. Where is the industry? Is it really booming right now?
The numbers are astonishing. I'll just give you a quick example. A few years ago, we were producing, you know, less than a billion gallons a year, and now we're on course to do 6 billion gallons a year. Now, what that means for all of us is this: that's still only 3% of all, that would be the equivalent of 3% of all the gasoline we consume in this country, but it's up from almost nothing. Now, they say you can only get to about 10%, and then you'll start running into some serious problems with the food supply, because you'll be using so much corn, which is what they're using now, for ethanol. But it is happening. I mean, there are 112 ethanol plants in the United States. A few years ago, there were barely a dozen. And there are another 76, not just on the drawing board, but being made now. Also, there's a ton of money going into this. It's a twofold thing. One is you have these small co-op-owned, farmer-owned ethanol plants that employ, say, 50 people and pay 100-some farmers for their grain. And now you have some big money. I mentioned in my story that Bill Gates, the richest man in the United States, has invested $84 million in this ethanol plant in Burley, Idaho, that was just announced. And you also have some big Wall Street money, too, Morgan Stanley, et cetera. And they see a chance for a quick return on venture capital because the government is now mandating that we have an ethanol level, and Bush has called for a fivefold increase in this mandated level.
And so these communities where these ethanol facilities are being built, are they seeing significant economic benefits, or is it too early to tell?
Well, I'll give you one example of a place that's had an ethanol plant for 10 years, Benson, Minnesota. And it really has turned the town around. They talked about how there's been a mini real estate boom. They authorized a new swimming pool. This is a town of 3,000 people, a farm country town. You know, there's new businesses on Main Street. The plant employs, I don't know, 60 people full-time, good wages. They're returning $60 million in shareholder equity mostly to local farmers. All that's good. But then you go and you look at the census figures, as I did, from 2000 to 2005, which gives you an update of what's going on. And the town itself and the county itself have both lost 5% of their population. So on the one hand, yes, it's an economic revitalization. But on the other hand, it's not keeping people from staying in small-town rural America.
You also mentioned the food supply. Do you think it's going to come down to making the choice between corn for food or corn for fuel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you followed this, but there were huge protests in Mexico a week or so ago by people protesting tortilla prices. Now, a lot of people blame that, accurately or inaccurately, on this rush for ethanol. Even the most optimistic ethanol, you know, visionaries say that we can only afford to go about twice or three times what we're doing now until we really do bump into the food supply problem. Corn now is at its highest price that it's been in a long time, if not forever, adjusting for inflation. And so there's just huge competition, you know, for corn for grain, and all the hog farmers, all the livestock farmers are complaining that corn, you know, they need this corn to feed their animals. And they say the prices are really high because it's going into basically moonshine, which is what ethanol is.
And what about effects on the environment?
Well, the concern there is twofold. One, you know, when you grow this, it does take carbon out of the atmosphere. But when in the process of producing it in factories and using it as fuel, it still does release some carbon into the air because it's blended with gasoline. So it's not entirely carbon neutral. In other words, it doesn't solve all your problems on global warming. It doesn't take... You know, it doesn't reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's better than petroleum-based product. Most of it's blended anyway. But the other concern is that there's so many chemicals used in producing, you know, the kind of corn that we produce right now in the United States. Big agriculture produces it in a certain way that uses a lot of chemicals and a lot of petroleum byproducts, diesel being the foremost among them, to raise this stuff. So there's real environmental concerns about that. And that is that, you know, if you industrialize rural America, if you add, say, another 20, 30, 40, 50 million acres in corn so that we can have ethanol, what will be the net effect on the environment? A lot of people are concerned about that.
Right. And you also write about another way to produce ethanol, right, without using corn. It's switchgrass?
Yeah, this is the great green hope that everyone has. I mean, Bush has mentioned it a couple times, and people said, what the hell is he talking about? And it's funny, you'll see all political sides united on this thing. There's almost no opponents to this. Switchgrass is the big green hope for this reason. It's a native grass. It's a perennial. It grows free on the prairie. It's what, you know, nature gave us without any chemicals, without any heavy irrigation. On the other side, it's wasted farm stuff. It's stuff they used to burn on the fields. The problem there is that there is no switchgrass or it's called cellulosic ethanol plant in the United States because it costs twice as much to produce it. It's harder to break down in the factory. It costs twice as much as corn ethanol. But there are proposals for two switchgrass plants in the United States. And eventually, this will be the thing that will get us on a true ethanol economy. But they have to figure out how to produce it in a cheaper way.
I read that there's a nonprofit group that has set a goal of producing 25% of the nation's energy needs by the year 2025. You think that's realistic?
Well, it's interesting. It's a really big-time group. I mean, they've got a lot of money behind them, and they've got a lot of strange political bedfellows, everybody from former aides to President Clinton to Newt Gingrich. everybody from the Turner Foundation to other organizations. So they've got a lot of money behind them. Their goal is to 25 by 25. Yeah, all of it would come from farms and forests, wood chips, that sort of thing. And right now we're at about, if you count, you know, renewables like hydro, we're at about 6%. So I don't know. It depends on how, you know, the government is pushing us this way with mandates. So it depends on where the
okay, Tim, are from. Tim, thanks very much for being with us. Sorry to cut you off. Tim Egan covers the American West for the New York Times. You're listening to Here and Now. It's day three of House debate about President Bush's decision to send additional troops to Iraq. Tomorrow, lawmakers vote on a non-binding resolution that's critical of the troop increase. The measure is expected to pass in the democratically controlled Congress, but a number of Republican lawmakers have said they will support it. Today, we're going to feature excerpts from the debate. While opponents of the resolution have said passing it will send the wrong message to U.S. troops, Representative Jan Schakowsky, a Democrat from Illinois, took issue with that.
The administration continues the charade that if you don't support this war and this escalation, then you don't support the troops. Shame on them. It is they who have failed to serve the troops who have served us so well. From day one, our troops were sent into the war theater without the proper equipment to maximize their safety. Families have bake sales to buy their loved ones better vests and helmets. Just last month, the Pentagon's Inspector General found that the Defense Department hasn't been able to properly equip the troops it already has with enough guns and ammunition to effectively complete their missions. That's a quote. Soldiers are short body armor, armored vehicles, and communication equipment. Imagine. This war is costing $12 million every hour, 24/7, for 4 years, nearly $500 billion, and our soldiers don't have enough body armor, ammunition, communications equipment. If our troops aren't the priority, who is? Halliburton, Blackwater, other corporate chums of the president, don't lecture us about caring for the troops.
Also, Republican Virginia Fox of North Carolina is voting against the resolution, saying it's hypocritical.
I'm appalled by what's happening in this chamber this week. We are taking full advantage of the freedoms that we have while good men and women are dying to protect us, and we're undermining their efforts. The other side has done some very awful things for political gain in this session, but this event is the pit of hypocrisy, not the height of hypocrisy. History has shown us that involvement in sending all the resources necessary was essential to winning World War II, and we did, in fact, preserve freedom and democracy. Many Americans were against World War II, calling for isolationism and pacifism, hoping that Hitler would stay true to his word, regardless of the extensive military buildup. The United States had no choice but to enter the war to save Europe and democracy. That was the definitive conflict of that era. We're now facing the definitive conflict of ours. Mr. Speaker, this is a tremendous disservice to our troops, their families, and the American tradition of being honorable liberators fighting for democracy. This resolution is an insult to our troops and the American people. We're leaders in our body. It's time we came together and act as leaders, leave politics aside to fight terrorism and support our troops.
Immediately following Congresswoman Fox was Representative Stephanie Tubbs Jones, a Democrat from Ohio.
I'm so proud to be an American. I'm so proud that we have First Amendment freedoms and why this House of Representatives has decided to step up and debate the issue of Iraq. I'm not ashamed that I want my troops to come home. I'm not ashamed to say that the babies that have died in Iraq that come from Cleveland, Chicago, Illinois need to come home and get out of harm's way. I'm not unpatriotic. I'm as patriotic as the rest. And I stand here to say to America today that the Democrats in this House of Representatives and the Democrats in the Senate want a debate. Fortunately, we have a strong leader in the House and we're debating. Somehow the Senate can't seem to get off of stupid and not have the opportunity to give us an opportunity to debate the issue of Iraq. I'm proud to be American. I'm proud to have troops who have stood up for us, have given their lives. It's time for us to stand up for them. Let's remember them. Let them not be numbers. Let them be people and their families know that we care about them. I give the rest of my time. I got too excited.
That's Representative Stephanie Tubbs Jones of Ohio. As we said, the House is expected to vote on the resolution tomorrow. As this debate winds down, Democrats are turning their attention to President Bush's request for nearly $100 billion more dollars for the war. Representative John Murtha of Pennsylvania, a veteran and opponent of the Iraq War, said he wants to forbid the Pentagon from sending additional troops unless the soldiers have adequate training and equipment. General Peter Schumacher, Army Chief of Staff, said protective gear for the troops is not a problem. He says, obviously, we are not going to put any force into action that isn't properly trained and equipped. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. One of the biggest surprises from this year's Oscar nominations is Clint Eastwood's film Letters from Iwo Jima. It's the companion film to his earlier work, Flags of Our Fathers. Both are about the World War II Battle of Iwo Jima. Even though Letters wasn't supposed to be released in time for Oscar consideration and is almost entirely in Japanese, the film picked up four nods, including Best Picture, for its tale of the vastly outnumbered Japanese forces on the island of Iwo Jima who refused to surrender, though their thoughts and letters were of home.
Hanako, この手紙が届くことはないだろう。でも、お前と赤ん坊のことだけが気がかりだ。
Letters from Iwo Jima also picked up a nomination for Best Original Screenplay for Iris Yamashita. Iris wrote the movie from a story she co-authored with Paul Haggis, who's no stranger to the Academy. He picked up two Oscars last year for the drama Crash. Haggis also wrote Eastwood's Million Dollar Baby and co-authored Flags of Our Fathers. But for Iris Yamashita, this is her first nomination, and she joins us from the NPR studios in Culver City, California. Welcome.
Thank you.
And it's your first major film.
Yes, it is. Very, very exciting.
Yeah, so that's a little surprising. Was it surprising for you?
Oh, yes, definitely. When we started, we weren't sure, or my agent and I weren't sure. We thought maybe it might just be a companion movie on the DVD, and it ended up being an actual theatrically released movie. And then when it started getting qualified for awards, we were so ecstatic. It was so exciting.
I've read that it was important for Clint Eastwood that he have a Japanese-American writer in this film. Do you think you brought a different perspective?
Yes. I know Clint Eastwood was really interested in doing the Japanese perspective when he started doing pre-production on Flags of Our Fathers. And he approached Paul Haggis first, but Paul Haggis felt he wasn't qualified, and they wanted to bring in a Japanese-American person to write the story. And I think that really helped because I was able to look at both sides in kind of a fairly even manner.
Mm-hmm. Clint Eastwood really got his inspiration for this film when he was researching Flags of Our Fathers, and he came across the letters of General Kuribayashi. And he was the general in charge of the Japanese troops on Iwo Jima. You've read some of these letters. What impressions do you get from those letters about the general?
Most of them were from his time when he was living in America. So they were very cute letters to his family, to his son mostly, who was a toddler at the time. And there were many pictures that he drew. This is what American people wear. This is what they play. What are you doing? You know, very, very cute. I think it just struck me, and I'm not sure if Clint had the same reaction, but thinking that this very sensitive, kind-hearted person was the leading commander of a very vicious battle on Iwo Jima.
He's played by Ken Watanabe, and he apparently did a lot of research about the general, and he had some ideas about how about how things were going to be done. How much of an influence did he have in the film?
I did have a great respect for Ken Watanabe for the amount of research that he did, and he was very, very into what he thought the character was like, and we would have these lengthy discussions of would he do this or would he do that. A lot of his contribution also is to making sure that the dialogue was natural. They had a studio version translation, and he was not satisfied with that, so he found a couple other translators to do their translations, and then I think the final version was a combination of the three taking the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to some of that dialogue. This is Ken Watanabe as General Kuribayashi sharing a drink with one of his men after he finds out that most of his air and sea support has already been destroyed.
国民だけでなく我らも欺くつもりなのか。正直に申し上げてもよろしいですか、閣下。最も賢明な措置はこの島を海の底に沈めてしまうことだと思います。それでも君はここへ来た。
And he also wanted to have a say about how his character met his end, which has been a mystery.
Yes, that's correct. I had read several historical accounts of what they think happened, and it's all a mystery though, because they've never found his body and they don't know exactly what happened to him. But I was going by what I had found in the research, but Ken, being so into his character, said, no, I don't think he would have done that, because I know his character and I don't think he would have done that. So he came up with his own take of how he might have died.
Mm-hmm. We spoke with some veterans of Iwo Jima, some American veterans, about the film and the battle. And one thing that they brought up that they found really difficult to understand, really, was why didn't the Japanese surrender, even though they knew that they were so outnumbered? Can you talk about writing that in here, that idea that was portrayed throughout the film, that death was better than surrender?
Yeah, at that time, it was a very militaristic regime. And one of the things that I found interesting about the differences between America and U.S., and talk about Flags of Our Fathers and letters from Iwo Jima, on the American side, it was usually the ones who came back that were the heroes, whereas in Japan, it was disgraceful to come back. If you came back, you were a coward. So your options were basically to either be killed in battle or commit suicide. I had read accounts not only of soldiers but of civilians who committed suicide rather than being taken by the Americans. You didn't have a choice either, because if you didn't do it, then the militant officers would kill you.
Right. The film actually premiered in Japan before it came here, and apparently it had quite an emotional response in Japan. Have you heard any reaction from Japan about what's happened there?
I had some personal stories from friends. Like there was a friend of mine who, I didn't know this, but she took her mother to see the movie, and her mother was very moved and was crying. And apparently her mother never met her father because her father died in the war.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so the movie really resonated with her.
Hmm. I've read that it's not really discussed much in Japan.
From what I understand, a lot of the young people don't even know the history of World War II in Japan. So this movie is helping to educate them. And the older people, I guess, don't like to talk about it. But with this movie, they're starting to be able to talk about it and to mourn their relatives that they lost.
And let's get back to your story, if we could, for a minute. As we said in the beginning, this was your first major film, and you're with, Paul Haggis and Clint Eastwood. Is that a little bit intimidating ever?
Yes, that was very intimidating. I was very nervous. But, my first meeting with Clint Eastwood, he's such a laid-back person who's really down to earth and very intelligent. And just talking with him in that room, I felt very comfortable. And I was, really honored and felt, yes, he's the right person to do this.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't feel like you had to give in all the time, huh? that you actually could write the way you wanted to?
Yeah, actually, I turned in my first draft, and Clint Eastwood called me on the phone and told me that he loved it, and he just wanted to go with the first draft.
Wow.
So it was really surprising.
Wow.
But I hear that's the way he is with a lot of his movies. In fact, with Million Dollar Baby, Paul Haggis said the same thing, that Clint just went with his first draft, and Paul thought, well, even I would have changed it if I was directing it.
So now we're in all this sort of hoopla over the Oscars. What's that like?
Oh, gosh, it's very surreal. Yeah, I feel kind of like Dorothy in the Land of Oz, and any minute I'm going to wake up and I'll find myself back in Kansas.
Well, congratulations and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Iris Yamashita is the Oscar-nominated screenwriter for Letters from Iwo Jima. The Academy Awards are next Sunday. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.